So this talk is it's necessary for the recording, isn't it? It's an attempt to combine to combine two things. It's about research and data words, which is a new, not very new, 10 or 15 years field in automata theory, and a direction that that is pursued by semantic people and originated in logic, which is nominal sets. So I want to sort of, what my message is that using nominal sets is a nice and elegant formalism to talk about data words, and that's what our message is, and this is the we have some technical results, but I think the message is the most important thing. So in my talk, I will tell you just a little bit about data words, a little bit about nominal sets, and I will concentrate on one example. Okay, so I begin with data words. Traditionally, in automata theory, if you have an automaton, then it has a finite alphabet, like ABC or AB. And in data words, what you have is you have an infinite alphabet. So suppose that your alphabet is natural numbers. And the motivation for this is that, say, words, or most importantly, maybe trees, where the nodes have very large labels, comes from, say, XML, where your tree would be the parse tree of an HTML document, and a typical label would be an attribute value, such as a URL, which is, can be very long. And people have developed a number of automata models that work over such data words, and one idea is to use registers, but there's other ideas, and I will tell you a bit more, give you some examples of these automata. Maybe one important thing, if you've never seen these data words, I said that the alphabet here in this particular example is the natural numbers, but you're not you don't use the structure of natural numbers. So for instance, the fact that 2 is equal to 1 plus 1, it's not going to be visible to the automaton. So it could just as well be any other countably infinite set in this particular example. So there is no structure. And actually, maybe one of the themes here is of this talk is to how to express formally that there is no structure. And the idea is very old. It's to express the notion of structure by saying what's an automorphism. And this is going to be appearing later on in this talk. So I just give you, for the moment, just give you several, I won't give you the automata, but I will give you the languages that they recognize. So here's a typical language of data words. It says, words where the first letter is the same as the last letter. Okay? I wrote it as a regular expression. Another example is that some letter appears at least twice. And you see that all of these examples, they don't use any structure of the set. It's just equality. And for the most of the time, it will just be equality. Later on, we will start to think about languages where you might be able to talk about order on data values, but for most of the time, it's just equality. And that's the kind of structure. And here's a third example, the complement of this one. All letters are different. And just to remark, so these ones were given using regular expression. This one is not a regular expression. Well, it uses complement, so it's not a regular expression without complement. And there's no reasonable notion of regular expression that works for this, so that kind of shows you what world we're living in. You don't have regular expressions, at least not in the sense that you have in the usual world. And another remark is that this very, very simple language, it kills half of the automata that exist. Okay, so that's how weak our automata are in data words. So I just give you some pictures of several automata models that have been developed. The point of this picture is not that you understand them, is that you see that there's a lot of models. Okay, so maybe one of the, and this it will be the running example of my talk. It's a model which is called deterministic register automaton, and the idea is that it's an automaton, but it's equipped with several registers, And when it scans the world left to right, it can load some of the input letters into its registers and maybe compare them to the input being read. So a typical thing it could do, it could load the first letter into its register and then see if that word appears again. Yeah? A typical thing it could not do is see if all the data values are different, because intuitively speaking, it would have to load all of them into its registers. Anytime it loses something, it's going to have to pay a price for that. You have the non-deterministic model, and this one could, for example, say that some letter appears twice. It non-deterministically picks the moment when it guesses that it sees the letter that will appear twice. It loads it into the register. It continues and sees if that happens. This cannot be done by a deterministic one. Actually, the complement of this language, as I mentioned before, it cannot be done by non-deterministic automaton as well. So that's the reason why it's not deterministic. Actually, universality for non-deterministic automata is undecidable. So that kind of shows you how careful you have to be with designing the automaton. Another very popular class is alternating automata with one register. So you this is a maximally powerful class of automata. So it can do something like all registers are different, but other things it can't do, and it has very high complexity. Another class is called something called data automata, which was introduced to deal with first order logic. And the expressive powers are incomparable, and there's other models, and drawing this Venn diagram is complicated. So my message is a lot of models, very incomparable, and it's not clear what the right one is. And it's certainly not clear what a regular language is. Okay, there's no unifying view. And here's another one, but it's not very interesting. So this is data work. Message, a lot of models, incomparable with expressive power, not clear which one is the regular languages, and maybe there is no good answer. And what I will do now is I will focus on one of these models, the deterministic register automata, and I will try to look at it in an abstract way to justify that it is a reasonable model. Okay. So this is the example. So it's deterministic register automata, which were introduced by Francis and Kaminsky in 1994. They call it finite memory automata. And the idea is what I explained to you. It's the deterministic variant. There's, of course, the non-deterministic one, but I will focus on the deterministic one. And you have several registers, which are fixed in advance. And the way you work is you have a state from a finite set of states, or location, as some people prefer. And when you read your new input letter, you're allowed to ask, how does that input letter relate to your register? So formally, I wrote it down as follows, that in the transition function, you get an equivalent, the equality relation, which says which registers are equal to each other, and which registers are equal to the input data value. The star is the input. So it's an equivalence relation on the registers and the input. It tells you who is equal to who and who is not equal to who. Okay? And then based on that information, you choose your new state and say you pick where to put your input data value. You might choose to put it nowhere, that's the start. It means throw it away. Now, I tried my best to give a short description, but I think it's ugly as it is anyway. And if you would, it would become even uglier if, for instance, you wanted to add more features, such as rearrange your registers, or maybe you wanted to, here I'm just allowed to throw the input data value. You could imagine a situation, and later on you will see that it makes sense, where at some point you decide that half of your registers are no longer necessary and want to throw them away. And if you wanted to add this kind of feature, it would become a very long expression, and it's very ugly. And if you come up to someone and say, this is my automaton model, that person is going to be justified asking whatever. Well, it's not a question, actually, but is going to be justified making this comment. And then the things become even worse if you try to talk about more complicated models like Turing machines or something, and there the definitions are very, very long, and it's difficult to say why these are reasonable. So I slightly change the focus for now, but I will try to answer that previous question. let us set ourselves a goal, which is we want to... No, I am trying to answer that question. I will try to... In finite automaton, classical finite alphabet, you have the Michell-Neroli theorem, which gives you a machine-independent characterization of regular languages. It says a language is regular if and only if there's finitely many equivalence classes. If you could have something like this here, then that would be a justification of that model. Okay, and so we want something like this. Okay? So that's the first one. That's the first reason why this would be useful. It would, if you had a Michell-Neroli theorem, you would justify that definition. And the second one is usually, well, always, if you have a Michell-Neroli theorem, that gives you a notion of minimal automata. Now, with the previous definition, you could have minimal automata, because you could say, I'm looking for the automaton with the smallest number of states, or maybe the automaton with the smallest number of transitions. I mean, there's always resources that you can try to minimize. But these questions are sometimes, maybe the number of states is an artifact of definition, and you tweak it somehow, and then you get a different notion of number of states, and maybe that's the problem of minimization is badly chosen under that definition. Actually, I claim it is. So I think if you have a Michell-Neroli theorem, and you produce the Michell-Neroli equivalence classes, and you say that's your minimal automaton, I think that's a more of a machine-independent and elegant way of defining minimality. And actually, we will see that it will give us some... It will give us a different notion of minimality than ones which you would come up with just by looking at that definition. So, before I state the theorem, I will just analyze one single example, show you the Michell-Neroli equivalence classes, and I hope that you will see the structure of those equivalence classes, and then it will be apparent to you what I'm talking about. So let's talk about this specific language, which is words where just two data values appear. Okay? They're not fixed in advance, so you just read a word, and if it so happens that that word uses two data values, that's okay. So it's a union of overall possible pairs of different data values, an infinite union, and then once that pair of data values is fixed, you're only allowed to use those data. And this is recognized by a deterministic register automaton, which just scans and uses two registers. Yeah? So, Michell-Neroli equivalence, I hope you know what I mean. You consider two words equivalent if they have the same futures with respect to the language. So there are two simple equivalence classes. The empty word is not equivalent to any other word because it hasn't declared any data value, so it's its own equivalence class. It's a finite equivalence class. And then there is one equivalence class which contains the words which have already had at least three data values, and there's nothing you can do to fix that. So that's one equivalence class. So these are two simple equivalence classes. And they basically don't talk about data. But there are infinitely many other equivalence classes, and there the data starts to play a role. I use the word data to refer to labels in the alphabet. So here's one. Once you have read the first letter, say the first letter happens to be one, and you have just unused ones. So this is one equivalence class. I just have one letter that I've just used. So there's one equivalence class for data for the letter A, 1, which is it has 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1 star generally. All of these words are equivalent. And likewise for other letters like 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, and so on. Okay, so there's infinitely many equivalence classes, one for each letter in the alphabet. And once you fix that letter in the alphabet, say 2, then you just have 2 star. All of these words are equivalent. It's one equivalence class. So already you have infinity plus 2 equivalence classes. But of course, what you're seeing here is that it looks like infinitely many equivalence classes, but I mean, they're all the same, yeah? So, and this all the same is what we're going to formalize. And then there's another equivalence class, which is once you have fixed two data values, so say you have a new data value, and then you have any combination of that. So each equivalence class like this is parameterized by two data values, and then once you have chosen those two parameters, then you just use any word which contains them in any order. So you have 2 times infinity plus 2 equivalence classes, okay? But I use the colors to underline the fact that you have essentially 4 equivalence classes. So in what sense there's 4 equivalence classes? We're going to use the notion of bijections of the alphabet. I hope this is clear from the picture that I have drawn. So suppose that I take any bijection of the whole alphabet. Okay? But it happens to map 1 to 2. It does other things for other letters as well, but it maps 1 to 2. If I apply that bijection to any word from here, it will map it to a word from here. Actually, it will map this class to exactly this class. So every word from here will be mapped to here and nothing else. Yeah? And in general, if I take any bijection of the alphabet, and I apply that bijection to something from here, to a class of this color, I will get another class of this color. So these classes form a single, it's what it's called, a single orbit under actions of bijection of the alphabet. Okay? Likewise, if I take any bijection of the alphabet, which say maps 1 to 1 and 2 to 3, it will map this equivalence class to this equivalence class. More generally, if I take any bijection of the alphabet, and I apply it to, say, this equivalence class, I will get another equivalence class like this, which means that all of these equivalence classes are in the same orbit with respect to actions of bijections of the alphabet. Here's another example, which is slightly more sophisticated. I take a non-trivial bijection, which maps 1 to 2 and 2 to 1. So it swaps 1 and 2. Yeah. So this bijection does, I mean, but it preserves this equivalence class. What this means is that an equivalence class like this is not really parameterized by an ordered two pair of data values, it's parameterized by an unordered pair of data values, and this will play a role. So what I'm saying is that maybe this language has infinitely many equivalence classes under Myhill-Neroli equivalence, but it has finitely many equivalence classes if you consider them modulo the action of permutation of the alphabet. Okay, so that's the picture. And it's the theorem. So. Suppose that I'm only interested in languages which are closed under permutations of the alphabet. Observe that the model of register automata satisfies this property because it only compares things for equality. So this is the only kind of languages I'm interested in. And in generally, people who study data words, at least as far as equality is concerned, these are the only kinds of languages that you're working with. And then, there's a mess up. Sorry. This is going to reappear. But fortunately, I will be short of time, so you will not see all my slides and not all the mess. This is a very straightforward fact to prove, that if you start off with a language which is closed under permutations, then, and you look at the diagram of the Myhill-Neroli classes, then every equivalence class will be mapped to another equivalence class by permutations. That means it's a congruence with respect to Myhill-Neroli equivalence. Okay? And the theorem says that the following two conditions are equivalent. A language is recognized by a deterministic register automaton if and only if it is permutation closed and there are finitely many orbits, finitely many colors. So if you, one implication is easy. If you take a deterministic register automaton and you permute the alphabet, basically the finiteness comes from the fact that it has finitely many states. This top-down direction is easy. What is more difficult is the bottom-up implication, because you start off with an abstract object, which is a set of equivalence classes modulo the action of permutations of the alphabet. And then from that, you have to reconstruct a concrete automaton. And that is more difficult. And actually, what you discover is that if you want to do the reconstruction, the automaton you will reconstruct, it is going to have the same expressive power as some other deterministic register automaton, but it will not be a deterministic register automaton per se. So if you look at what you extract here automatically, you will get a slightly richer class. It has the same expressive power, but it has more relaxed syntax. Example. So let's come back to that one. I use the same equivalence classes rearranged in a different order. As usual for the Myhill-Neroli relation, you can just have the automaton. Yeah? So I start off in the empty word, I read letter 1, I end up here. If I keep on reading letter 1, I have a loop and so on. This is the syntactic automaton. It's defined for any permutation closed language. And this is our syntactic automaton. Now I would like to tell you that this is like a register automaton. Okay? And it looks very much like a register automaton. It will have, so it begins, initially it has nothing in its register. Then when it reads the first letter, it stays in this state, and basically the state is called, I have just read one letter, and it has one register. And in that one register, you store the data value, say 2. So already here, there's a slight difference, it's not very important, that the number of registers kind of depends on the state. So here I have zero registers, here I have one register, but you could recover that having undefined registers, not very important. What's interesting is what happens here. So this state here, it can be reached by two paths like this. And essentially what this state is having, it has a register, but this register is storing an unordered pair of data values. So if you want to consider this automaton as a special case of some concrete model, you would have to extend the model by allowing registers which store unordered pairs of data values. Okay, well, that's not bad. But then you can come up with automata which have require even more sophisticated register structures. So for instance, you might want to have an automaton, here's a silly example, which stores a quadruple of data. So an unordered pair is something like this, yeah? It says I have data value D, I have data value E, but I don't care if they're swapped. But you could have a quadruple up to cyclic permutations. You can come up with a language such that if you draw this diagram, actually the register structure that you need is quadruples of data values up to six cyclic permutations. And you can do that for actually any permutation group. So the kind of automaton that you need in this special case is register automata with the additional structure that the set of registers equipped with a group acting on it, a symmetry group. And if this is your new extension of the definition, you will have the theorem which says that they are exactly the same. So if the minimal automaton which is obtained by the Meissner-Nerodi equivalence is actually in this class. Okay. So this is the running example. Yes. Because I think I have much less time than I... How much time do I have? So
8 minutes.
I have 8 minutes. The short answer is yes. It also extends to other variants when you have, say, order on data values and so on. I will get to that in a moment. So my point was that if you took an abstract view of this, you recovered a more abstract definition, which is slightly different, but I would say more elegant, and I will tell you now the setting where all of this lives. It's called nominal sets. Okay. So I will stay with the example where I had D was A previously. I'm sorry for the change. So I have an alphabet of data values, and now if I'm interested in equality, then I have a notion of legal permutations. In the case of equality, it's all bijections. But you can imagine that, for instance, if I had order on data values, I could have only restrict my group of permutations to, say, those which preserve the order. But in an abstract sense, I have a parameter now which tells me what is my structure on my data values. So the abstract input is a set D, equipped with a group of bijections. The idea is that this group of bijections tells you what the structure is. Okay? Examples include a countable set with all bijections. Another example is when D is the rational numbers and the group consists of order-preserving functions. And actually, there are several other examples, and they're all basically what Manuel Bodirsky had yesterday. They are Frise limits. So another example would be that D is the Radow graph and G is the set of its automorphisms. Another example would be that D is the set of the universal partial order with its automorphisms, and so on. So this is an input. So I take this parameter. It kind of tells me what my alphabet is and what the structure is. Okay, and using this input, I define a new notion of sets. Okay, so based on this input, I define a new notion of set, and I will work in those sets. So first of all, it works in two steps. It's first of all, I need to have G sets, which are sets equipped with an action. I'm sure you're familiar with definition. So a G set, and G is the group up there, is a set X such that you are allowed to apply elements of the group to that set, to elements of that set. So for each permutation from the group, you are allowed to transform X And you have the natural axiom of an action which say that it's compatible with the group structure. So now it will no longer be sufficient to, in this set theory, to just give you a set. I will also have to equip that set with a group action. But even that would be not sufficient, because I will have to do more. I will have to satisfy a certain condition, which is defined here. And it says as follows. So I'm only allowed to use nominal sets. When is a G set a nominal set? It says that the essential idea is that for every element of the set, think of X being, say, a D star. Okay? If you take the set X, big X, to be D star of data words, you will observe that if you take any fixed data word, such as, say, 5, 7, 5, for this data word, only the data values 5, 7, and 5 are important, and the other ones are not important, which means that if I apply a bijection 5 of the alphabet to this data word, then I only really care what it does to 5, 7, and 5, and I don't care what it does to other things. And this is expressed here in an abstract way. It says that a G-set has this finite memory kind of thing. It's called nominal. If for every element there is a finite set of data values called the support of that element, such that if I have a permutation and I know what that permutation and that permutation does not do anything to the support. It could do things to the unimportant data values. But if it doesn't touch the support, then it doesn't touch the element. So this is a new notion of set. Well, it's not new. It's 70 years old. It was introduced by Frenkel in 1922, when he was trying to prove the independence of the axiom of choice. So I just repeat it shortly. You have a new notion of set. Your parameters are a set of data values D and a group G. And now, instead of just giving a set by its elements, you have to give an action of the group, and it's not any set with any action, but it has to satisfy this kind of thing. And I give you some examples of nominal sets. So the set of data values itself is a nominal set. It's equipped with the action, because the group is the permutation. And the support of a single data value is just the data value itself, because if the permutation preserves that, then it preserves. This is a triviality. A slightly more, you have Cartesian products, because if you have two nominal sets and you take their product, then you can, if you extend the group action pointwise, then you also get a group action, but it also preserves this finite support thing, because if you know the important data values for this and the important data values for this, the important data values for the pair are the union. It might sometimes even be small. This is the important example here. If I take the set of all data words and I apply the action letter by letter, it's also a nominal set, and the idea is that the important data values for a word are the ones that appear there. So now, an example of something that's not nominal. And maybe I just go quickly to the end, because I think I don't want to waste your time. What this paper is about is as follows. We say that if you start to work in nominal sets, it's a new set. In set theory, you have a new notion of function. What's important, you have a new notion of finite set. You just rewrite in this new set theory the definition of a finite automaton. You write the same exact definition of a finite automaton, which is inputs a state, a letter produces a new state. Then you can prove that it's equivalent to models that have existed. So the message of this talk is that this is a very nice abstraction for dealing with automata over data words. So that's the conceptual message of our paper, which is to use nominal sets as a language to talk about data words. There is a technical contribution, which is more or less as follows. These definitions were all quite abstract. I mean, sets with actions and orbits. And how can you manipulate this? How can you store these things in the memory of a computer? So for instance, how can you write an algorithm which inputs a finite automaton if that finite automaton is defined as some ridiculously abstract object? So the technical contribution is that for reasonable choices of groups and data values, which are basically Frise limits, all of this can be actually done algorithmically. So the automata can be stored in the memory of a computer, they can be manipulated, and many algorithms that work in the classical world also transfer here. That's the technical contribution of the paper. Well, thank you.